Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a health, food, and environmental journalist writing on the Huffington Post and Alternet, as well as hosting this show now in its third year. Every year on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between our personal health and our global health environment. For many years, I was a reporter on integrative medicine and all the things that we can do to take care of our health as individuals. But over the last 8 years, I've been covering what we need to do to take care of our health through social policy, in our communities, in our society, and on Earth, because many of these larger systemic forces in which we unwittingly participate as individuals are threatening health and life on Earth. And so every week on this program, we discuss this with different thought leaders, authors, experts, scientists, advocates, physicians, and others to kind of get a handle on this and hopefully get more engaged and active to address it. So given that as our theme, I'm very thrilled to have on today's show Elizabeth Colbert, who is the author of a very important book about one of the major topics that we cover on Connect the Dots, and that is what mankind is doing to threaten other species, ourselves, and our habitat. Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. She was a former longtime reporter as well for the New York Times. Her previous book is Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. And, you know, she's been covering climate change and all that that entails. The current book, just out and a must-read, is called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, and we'll be discussing that today with her on the show. And so I couldn't be, more delighted to warmly welcome to Connect the Dots, Elizabeth Colbert.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Your book is, you know, we talk about climate change a great deal in terms of the weather. And, you know, I think that's kind of the part of it that, you know, there's been some considerable denial about, a lot of scientific research and projections about, and I think it's become more a part of more people's experience. Even over the last 2 years and even just this last year, due to changes in the weather, that people are experiencing, unlikely storms, hurricanes, droughts, floods, and this is going on both in the United States as well as globally. Several years back in 2011, we had the bad confluence of a tsunami with a nuclear power plant, and all of these events are kind of drawing our attention beyond the manufactured debate about climate denial to the reality. What your book talks about is what we're actually, the same forces, the same man-generated forces, are doing to living species and to biodiversity, which is the range of interconnected species that exists here on planet Earth and that are, a foundational, intimate part of our ability to exist here. And your book talks about the decline of these species and the threat of what you characterize as the sixth extinction. And in that, I think it's very unusual and sheds it looks at a whole different side of the effects of man-made activity. Let's begin by discussing, I think many people are probably unaware there was ever, that we're at risk for a sixth extinction and that there ever were prior extinctions. I guess we kind of think about dinosaurs growing up when we were little kids and that sort of thing, and the fact that they're not here right now. Can you set the bigger context of the extinctions that have occurred in the past?
Yes, sure. If you go back and look at the fossil record, you find there are these, well, not you, but scientists who have done this, find that there are these five moments in the last half billion years, and the reason that people look at the last half a billion years is because that's really the period from which we have fossils of large, complicated animals. They really didn't exist much before 500 million years ago. Mm-hmm. So the fossil record is not there. And so you look at this record and you see that there are these five moments in time where there are these really big breaks, sort of plunges in the number of families of organisms. And this, whether these were real, constituted real drops in diversity, or whether they were just flaws in the fossil record. Charles Darwin, for example, thought that they just reflected some kind of absence in the fossil record. He did not believe that there could be these big, sudden declines of life. And for a long time, that theory held sway. Darwin was always incredibly influential, you know, rightly so. And mm-hmm. so that held sway until really the 1980s, when a scientist named Walter Alvarez first proposed what's become known as the impact hypothesis, which proposed that asteroid impact had ended what's known as the Cretaceous period and killed off the dinosaurs and many, many, many other groups of organisms on the planet. And that caused people to go back and reassess these breaks. And it's now, you know, very, very widely agreed that these moments do represent sudden radical changes on the face of the planet when the diversity of life did very suddenly drop, and they occurred, you know, very rapidly in the sense of geological time. And the very first of them goes back 450 million years ago to what's known as the Ordovician period. And what's interesting about that is that in the Ordovician, life had not yet emerged from the water. So all of life was really aquatic. So that was a very devastating event for aquatic life, but not for life on land, because there simply wasn't life on land. And then the fifth, the most recent, is the asteroid impact that ended the reign of the dinosaurs. And you will often hear, I have heard scientists say now, that we are the asteroid, people are the asteroid. We are changing the planet so quickly and so dramatically that we are sort of tantamount to an asteroid.
For our listeners who are not familiar with that, how, which, I mean, or only thinking about it in terms of, you know, weather impacts, which is what we can most directly, as humans, perceive, how are we changing the planet? What are we doing that is changing the planet? I know that's a very broad question there.
Yeah.
But if you could highlight.
Well, I look at several ways in which we're changing the planet on a very dramatic, you know, global scale. And to be honest, I could have chosen several other ways. I just, you know, didn't want the book sort of just to become a kind of catalog. So what I look at are climate change, which is, you know, as I'm sure your listeners know, a function of all of the carbon dioxide that we're putting up into the atmosphere by virtue of, you know, driving our cars and running our factories and our power plants and activities that we consider to be really, really ordinary, but which are actually quite extraordinary in terms of the history of the Earth, because when we burn fossil fuels, what we're doing is we're taking, you know, really what we're organisms, all the fossil fuels is organic, that were buried underground under very specific circumstances for a very, very long time. Most of our fossil fuels are tens, in some cases hundreds of millions of years old, and we're combusting them and we're putting that carbon back into the air very, very rapidly. So we're sort of running geological history backwards and at a very high speed. And as people know, that has the effect of warming the planet very rapidly, once again on a geological scale, and very dramatically. Once again, we are probably pushing the planet out of the climate regime that has reigned since humans evolved, which is only about 200,000 years ago. So we're clearly leaving that. And, you know, if we continue on this much longer, we're going to push the climate back to a stage that it probably hasn't been in for many, many millions of years. So that's one way in which we're changing the planet. But carbon dioxide emissions also have another very important impact, sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin, which is that a lot of the CO2 we put up into the air ends up in relatively short order being absorbed by the oceans. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid, a weak acid called carbonic acid, which is, you know, what you drink when you're drinking a Coke, you're drinking that. So it's not, you know, a very strong acid, but you put enough of it into the water and you change the water chemistry. And that's exactly what we're doing. And it's very clear that that's going to have, you know, major effects on ocean life. It already is probably affecting ocean life. There's a very, very real possibility, some would say a certainty, that coral reefs are going to be devastated by this. Corals seem to have a hard time dealing with it. Coral reefs are a, you know, major ecosystem that supports many, 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 hundreds of thousands, probably millions of species. So that's another way that we're changing the world in a very dramatic, you know, planetary way. We're moving things around the world. So when we, you know, we also consider this very ordinary, that we, when we, you know, move species around the world. But once again, when you think about it, very, very unusual for a land species to be able to cross the ocean or an ocean species to be able to cross the water. So that's another way we're sort of rearranging the world. And then the other way that I talk about is just habitat destruction. We're just, you know, raising a lot of the world's forests, rainforests. Everyone has heard of that, about that, and that has, you know, fairly obvious impacts. And beyond just destroying habitat, we're also fragmenting it, so dividing it into little pieces, and that also has very serious impacts.
You know, so thank you for that overview. You know, what the time frames that you're speaking of, in terms of how long mankind has been on Earth, humankind has been on Earth, as well as, you know, the ancient, you know, the millions of years that we're talking about for the creation of the fossil fuels, for example, that are being burned, you know, it's really hard for most people to, you know, even know who presidents 100 years ago were, no less get their minds around, you know, these kinds of time frames. I've covered fracking a great deal for about the last 5 or 6 years, and I remember being present at a public meeting with some upstate New York farmers who were wishing to lease their land for fracking. And there was a Q&A with some panelists at this meeting, and one of them submitted a question, which was, once they come and frack and take the gas out of the ground, how quickly does it replenish?
Right. Yes, I think that does give you a sense of, you know, people live in the here and now, and right. The answer to that question, as you know, is really effectively never. Right. Yeah. So yes, I think that's a very good example.
Yeah. So we're dealing with, you know, things that have very long trajectories, and yet, you know, we you know, have a very short-term ability to kind of understand and perceive reality, and that's kind of what we're up against. So let me ask the obvious question as well, because when I cover this, I hear, you know, all these kinds of questions. But why should humans, because, you know, humans are very human-centric, why should we be concerned about the acidification of the oceans or the destruction of coral reefs and the wildlife that they support? How would that potentially affect humans?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of different ways that you could answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one way is simply to say, look, this is the extraordinary variety and beauty of the world. Anyone who has, you know, been on a coral reef knows what an extraordinary profusion of life is there, and how fantastically beautiful it is. You can just say, well, this is the majesty and sort of wonder of our planet. It took tens of millions of years for these ecosystems to evolve, and we're unraveling them, you know, really, really quickly. So one would think if you cared about anything, you know, you would care about that. Let's just put it that way. Now, if you say, well, that's just really too abstract for people, you know, what does it mean to me today, right now, in my daily life? Then I guess there are a couple things I could say. First of all, you know, there are really practical ways in which many people, probably not a lot of your listeners, depend on reefs, you know, just for their protein. You know, many, something like a billion people around the world depend on fishing as their source of protein, and fish are, many species are very dependent on coral reefs. So fishing obviously will be, you know, pretty seriously impacted, already is being very seriously impacted by a variety of impacts, not just, you know, ocean acidification. And then lastly, and this is sort of, you know, the big question mark hovering over us, as it were, is, you know, one of the lessons of the past is that, I quote a British paleontologist who says that at these moments of mass extinction, and they're, you know, moments, once again, in a geological sense, the rules of the survival game seem to change. So for whatever reason, groups that were once dominant can be wiped out, even though they were doing fine. You know, the dinosaurs were doing fine for tens of millions of years, for a lot, lot longer than humans or even primates have been on the planet. The dinosaurs were doing just fine. And then something happened, the rules changed, and they all disappeared. All species of non-avian dinosaurs disappeared. So when the rules change, you know, you just don't know exactly what the fallout is going to be. And there's no guarantee, even if you're part of the dominant species, that, you know, things are going to work out fine.
I come across this reporting on health a great deal. Somebody, some very high net worth individuals, major kind of well-known financial people, investors in the financial world, and, you know, one of their philanthropic interests is some kind of longevity society, where, you know, some doctors are getting together and trying to come up with some DNA altering substances or in order, you know, to help people live you know, past 100 years. And so you know, the contrast between, you know, that wish and that, the sense that we could manipulate reality in our favor, to prolong an individual life, you know, in the face of what your book, is documenting, is, you know, to me fairly shocking. So I'm going to, ask you a kind of a little bit of a hardball question and see what you do with it. You know, supposing that somebody now who's like, say, a healthy multi-billionaire 30-year-old, you know, could manage to prolong their life for another 100 years due to these manipulations, you know, what kind of world might they find themselves in?
Well, that's the real question. You know, a famous physicist, I can't remember exactly who said, you know, predictions are hard to make, especially about the future. You know, what the world is going to look like 100 years from now is a question, and we're in the process, you know, of determining that. And so part of it, to be honest, depends on, you know, what we do. Do we continue to spew carbon into the atmosphere at the rate that we're doing now? And does that rate continue to ratchet up the way it has been for the last, you know, 50 years or so? You know, then things are very, very different. He or she is living on a very, very different planet, a planet that on some level is, you know, almost unrecognizable. As I say, you know, it's probably a good, you know, maybe average temperatures are, you know, 6, 7, even 8, you know, 8 degrees higher than they are now. So, you know, the many of the world's breadbaskets are probably, you know, have been turned into deserts and, you know, very, very radically different world, very different sea levels, you know, major cities in the process of being inundated by rising sea levels. You know, probably a great deal of devastation of major ecosystems as we know them. Now, you know, you have to lay on top of that, you know, if you're going to go that route and say, okay, you know, we're looking at really, really wrenching environmental change, then you have to ask yourself, too, okay, well, what is going to be the reaction of human society to those changes? How are people going to react? And then, you know, when you layer that on, you just have all sorts of unknowables, and so it becomes, you know, really hard to predict, but certainly it's not hard to imagine, you know, that things could be very, very ugly, that you wouldn't necessarily want to be around, even if you could prolong your life that way. And that is very, very sobering because, of course, you know, that is the world we're leaving to our kids and our grandkids. Mm-hmm. Now, to imagine another world, you know, a better world, a world in which these disasters have not transpired, unfortunately turns out to be much more difficult because, you know, we have a very large global population right now and we consume a lot of resources and ever greater resources, and there are many, many people in the world living, you know, in extreme poverty who would also like to consume more resources the way we Americans do, and one can't really begrudge them that. And so when you try to put together this picture of the world in which, you know, 7, 8, 9 billion people are living, you know, what we Americans consider to be comfortable lives, and that is not having a very, very significant impact on the planet, it's very, very hard to do that.
Mm-hmm. So you looked at that. You've looked at multiple sides of this. You know, I think that's there are sort of a whole bunch of sort of questions and ruminations and challenges facing people, facing us, you know, as we look at these things. We have like about another 5 minutes before the station break, so I want to go into that a little bit more in the second part of the show. But for now, you know, one of the things about your book is that you look at these different species under threat. You go to their habitats. You talk to the scientists who study them. And, you know, how is that to actually go in the place? Because I think one of the virtues of the book, one of the gifts of the books, is that it kind of takes us there. And yet, ordinarily, you know, we don't go there. We're not thinking about the frogs.
Right.
We're, you know, what was it actually like for you to go there?
Well, one of the points that I often make, you know, people ask me, this, well, isn't this all, you know, terribly distressing, and the fact is it is, you know, really terribly distressing. But one of the sort of paradoxical things about my job in writing this is it was in the process of writing it, as you say, I got to go to some of the most extraordinary places on the planet, you know, those places that relatively speaking remain intact, such as the Great Barrier Reef, which is just an extraordinary place, and I went out with some scientists who were studying the, you know, even though we were in this really remote place, this tiny little island that just pokes above the waves. It was called One Tree Island. It was almost like a cartoon little island, just a couple feet above the waves. And it was really made out of the reef. The whole island was made out of coral. And they were doing water sampling, and they would do it day and night. And so we would walk out sort of over the reef. You can walk out on what's known as the reef flat. It's sort of this flat part of the reef, and you can walk over it. And you know, when you did that, you just saw the most amazing life, these sharks and giant turtles and these giant clams that have these algae, these really colorful algae that live inside of them, and sort of they look like they're sort of leering at you. They look like they have lipstick on. They're really fantastic creatures. And so you see these remarkable things when you get to go out on the reef, and then if you go snorkeling, as we did, or diving, as some people did, you know, you see this incredible shimmering world that exists beneath the waves that we very rarely see. We only really see in nature movies, most of us. And so I really got to see that, and that was just fantastic. you know, even as I was in this remote place documenting human influences on the planet, which are everywhere. There's really nowhere on Earth you can go now and not find the impacts of people. So it was sort of one of the interesting ironies of this journey to go these amazing places, very far, hard to get to, and to be there looking at the impacts of people.
Can you share with our listeners, you know, one of the kinds of impacts that you saw that that really stood out for you?
Well, you know, you
of
don't.
Of course, the book is full of that.
You know? On some level, the complexities you don't see them. You have to sort of measure them over time, right? So if you go to the Great Barrier Reef, for example, you don't see what's happened over the last 30 years because you are only getting that instantaneous snapshot. So, you know, one of the things that was going on is that people were, you know, trying to collect long data sets over time so that they could, in fact, look at, you know, what had happened over time. So, for example, when I was out on the Great Barrier Reef, people were looking at comparing what was going on now in terms of how the reef was growing and to data that had been collected almost 40 years ago and trying to see what sort of changes had taken place. And in fact, the changes that are taking place on the Great Barrier Reef are very dramatic. Some studies have shown that coral cover, so sort of the amount of the reef that's covered by live corals, has declined by almost half just in the last 30 years or so.
That's very dramatic.
Yes, very. And some reefs are in even worse shape. I mean, the reefs in the Caribbean, to be honest, are in even worse shape.
We are going to take a break for station identification here on Progressive Radio Network. Please stay with us, listeners. I'm talking with Elizabeth Colbert, the author of The Sixth Extinction. We'll be back for the second half of the show after we've heard station identification. It's a fascinating book, very important topic. Please stay with us. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots, the second half of our show. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We're talking today with Elizabeth Colbert, the author of The Sixth Extinction, and on natural history. This is a book about how mankind's activities here on Earth are actually resulting in major loss of many millions of species and biodiversity, and in fact threatening the continuity of human life on Earth as well. And that's what we're discussing on today's show. If you've just tuning in, you can find the show later today in archives. Please like us on iTunes, as well as sharing the program with others whom you think would be interested. And I highly encourage everyone to go out and read this book. What's really extraordinary about the way Elizabeth Colbert writes about this is that it's a very sad and poignant it's a tragic topic, in fact, but the strength of her observation, the clarity of her journalism, it's not like you're not crying your way through every page, let's put it that way, which I know I personally was concerned about, because, you know, what we're doing here on this planet right now is just really horrific, and as many people do, you know, I love wildlife, I love animals. It's really tragic what we're doing in this terribly short-sighted way, but the strength and ballast of her observation and reporting actually make the book something that both informs us and our actions, but it's also, a very a good read, and in some ways satisfying to really look right into what we're doing in this way. So I want to highly recommend the book as we return to our conversation with Elizabeth Colbert. What has been, I'm really curious, I mean, you write in The New Yorker, you've written for The New York Times, obviously there's environmental reporting in those outlets, What have you found? I'm just really curious in terms of doing, a media tour with this book. How open, receptive, well-informed are, the journalists and media personalities who cover, have to kind of alert the public to what's going on here? How are they encountering you and your book in terms of their receptivity and an understanding of the issue and concerns that you are representing in it?
Well, I have been really impressed, really, by heartened, I guess, by the reception the book has gotten. It is a very sobering subject. I tried to write the book in a way that was, I hesitate to use the word entertaining, but I hope there are a lot of good stories in there, I hope.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it's a good read, but I understand it's a very, sobering and tough to take topic. Mm-hmm. But it's gotten I want to say I've been really amazed by the reception it's gotten. The book has been on the bestseller list for the last couple of weeks. It was, it's gotten generally very nice reviews. I was on Jon Stewart, I think that people, I'm going to interpret that as that people, do realize, even though, they haven't connected the dots, to use the term, on this show, that something pretty major is going on, that you can't be, 7 billion people living the way we're living and not be having a very major impact on other species and on the planet in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really great. That's really terrific. So there's been a lot of awareness raising, from your earlier book.
I hope so. I don't want to overinterpret things, but I hope so.
Mm-hmm. How did you become concerned and interested yourself in climate change, as a reporter?
Yeah, well, it really happened. It really goes all the way back to when Bill McKibben, who's now become really one of the environmental leaders of our time, he wrote a book back in the late 1980s. I think it came out in 1989, and on climate change, The End of Nature, which I really recommend to your listeners. It's really stood up over time and come to seem very, very prescient. And that was really sort of my first encounter even with the concept. And it was something that I became, interested in and concerned about. I was at the time covering politics for the New York Times. And then I went to the New Yorker in around the year 2000, and I was also covering politics there, but I had a lot of freedom to do other things, and I got this idea. It was right around the time that George W. Bush was elected, and he had run against Al Gore. He'd been sort of equivocal on the issue of climate change. Was it important? Wasn't it important? But then he announced that the U.S. was going to not participate in the in the Kyoto Protocol. He wasn't even going to take this treaty to the Senate, which presumably would have ratified it anyway, but he wasn't even going to bother, and the whole thing wasn't such a big deal. And at that point, I thought, well, the New Yorker is a wonderful venue to really get at, the great issues of our time, and is this one of the great issues of our time? I really, really ought to find out. I really ought to try to get to the bottom of this, and I set out to write a piece on climate change, and I very quickly encountered, the fact that there was a very strong scientific consensus that this was, in fact, a very big deal. It took me a while to figure out how to write it as a story, not just as a sort of white paper, and when I finally came up with this idea that I was going to go to this a small island in Alaska that is actually disappearing as a result of climate change. And I took that to David Remnick, who's the editor of The New Yorker, still is the editor of The New Yorker, and he said, well, if this is really such a big deal, you know, climate change, as you are claiming, then let's do a whole series. Let's do a three-part series. And that is really how the whole journey started. And so instead of doing just one piece on climate change in the Arctic, that was my original idea, I ended up doing three pieces. That ended up becoming a book. And then when I went to do another book, I was really looking, actually, to be honest, for another book on climate change, because it seemed, well, this is a really huge issue. I can't possibly, you know, have exhausted climate change.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to try to figure out what the next book would be, I kept bumping in, up against this idea or fact, I guess, that climate change is really only part of an even bigger story, and that even bigger story turns out to be the many ways, you know, that we're changing the planet on a sort of geological scale. And so, for example, you know, climate change and ocean acidification, which are intimately related, invasive species, habitat destruction, all of these things, you could write whole books on them, but when you sort of put them all together, you get this picture of a planet that's changing, you know, very fast and very dramatically. And unfortunately, you know, the side effect of all of these changes turns out to be extinction.
Mm-hmm. You know, if can humankind, this is kind of a trick question, but with impunity, kind of accept the extinction of other forms of life, and then kind of keep trundling on because there's some technological fix that would kind of keep us going. You know, if we had no, you know, humane concerns about this.
You know, I think that's the question. I can't. I can't answer that question. That is really the, you know, unfortunately, we seem sort of intent on answering that question. It seems like a very risky proposition, one that I wouldn't recommend we follow that course. But, you know, people, one of the points that I make in the book is that people have been at this for quite a long time. And one of the chapters of the book deals with Sumatran rhino, the Sumatran rhino. Every chapter has sort of a species that it is sort of its focus, and that I try to tell a story about. And one of the chapters is about the Sumatran rhino, which is one of the five remaining rhino species on the planet. All rhinos are in deep, deep trouble. Sumatran rhinos are in very deep trouble. There's probably only about 100 left in the world, and two of them live at the Cincinnati Zoo, and I spent a lot of time with them. They're really magnificent animals, actually very, very friendly, sort of like, I describe one as being sort of like an oversized dog, just a very, very sweet, you know, 2,000-pound animal that could, you know, easily, very easily kill you if she wanted to, but doesn't want to. The point that I make in that chapter is that large animals are very, very vulnerable to human impacts because they tend to have very low reproductive rates. So, you know, it's not an accident that most large mammals are in trouble right now, including our very nearest relatives. You know, the chimps and the gorillas and the orangutans are in very, very serious trouble. It is very, very possible that, you know, by the end of this century, we will not have any great apes in the wild anymore. You know, they will all basically have to be in little preserves. Or in zoos. That's the only place you're going to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And they are our very, very closest relatives. You know, we spend a lot of time looking for intelligent life on other planets. We really have intelligent life right here on our own planet, and we are really very, very rapidly killing it off. So that seems to me really couldn't be, you know, more tragic. But anyway, so big animals are very vulnerable. They have low reproductive rates. You don't have to depress those reproductive rates or increase the rate of adult mortality very much to bring those populations down. And eventually you do it and you get all the way to zero. And that's what's happening, you know, with the Sumatran rhino, which is really headed on this sort of glide path to extinction. And when we go back and look at what happened when humans reached different places, different continents, we see that the large animals, you know, fairly rapidly dropped out. So when humans reached Australia, remarkably early, 50,000 years ago, people reached Australia. And very rapidly, once again, in the context of sort of, you know, biological time, these amazing large animals that used to live on Australia's animals called diprotodons, which were these huge marsupials. They look sort of like giant, you know, guinea pigs a little bit. These enormous tortoises, enormous birds, they were all gone. And there's a pretty broad consensus among scientists now that that, you know, just had to do with people coming along, hunting them, not intending to drive them extinct, but, you know, driving them to extinction just by you know, killing off a few. Every once in a while, you can drive animals that have low reproductive rates to extinction. So we've been at this project, you know, for quite a long time now, I'm afraid.
Has basically getting to know more close up than most of us do some of these species and looking, you know, at what is going on here changed your own perception of your own species, of humans?
Yes, I absolutely think so. I mean, Carl Cecina, who's a marine scientist and a wonderful writer, he wrote a book called Song of the Blue Ocean, which I also really recommend. He has a line, which once again I'm not going to get exactly right, but it was about, the more I apprehend the miracle, the greater the tragedy. And I think what he means by that is, you know, the more you know about life on this planet and how remarkable it is, the more what's going on, you know, breaks your heart and makes you worried. I mean, so, you know, unfortunately, most of us now live in places where, you know, we have very, very little contact with the incredible wonders of other species. But the more that you do, you know, I don't think there's anyone out there who's, you know, studying life in the rainforest who isn't just overwhelmed, you know, with sadness by what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, does this kind of shifts the ground a little bit? You know, of what you're setting out to cover, but it's like the implicit question all throughout your book, The Sixth Extinction, which is, you know, what is it with man, humankind? I mean, are we missing some kind of moral or ethical dimension? What is going on with us? And, of course, there's always the what can you do about it question, which I know I always feel as a journalist very often. It's enough, you know, that we inform you about this. Do we have to, it's not for us to necessarily propose a solution to
right.
it.
Right.
You know, that's kind of going a bit far and
right, above our pay grade,
Yeah, spoon-feeding people. But nevertheless, you know, I'd love to hear your, I'm sure you must, ruminate on, what is there an inborn deficiency or is it a cultural
issue? I really think that, I guess I would almost flip that around. I mean, it's our, mm-hmm. humans are really unusual and, you know, most of the discoveries of science of the last several centuries have tended to sort of, you know, knock people out of their place at the center of the universe. You know, we now know that the, you know, sun doesn't revolve around the earth. The earth revolves around the sun. We know that we are a product of evolution, just like everything else, every other life form on the planet. You know, our planet isn't necessarily even particularly special. There may be lots of other planets like this out in the universe. So we have come to sort of be knocked off our pedestal a bit, but I think one of the points that I hope comes through in the book is that we actually are rather unusual, and that what we're discovering now is sort of tending to put people, you know, back not on a pedestal, but in a central, very uncomfortable even position as creatures that are determining, you know, the future of life. That's a huge, you know, responsibility for which we are, you know, pretty evidently ill-prepared. But that's where we find ourselves. And the reason that we find ourselves in this position is because we are very, very unusual in the history of life. We are creatures that do not rely on normal processes of evolution to, you know, either outcompete our competitors or take on a new kind of prey, right? We if we decide we're going to, you know, go after something, some species at the bottom of the ocean, we can do it because we'll invent a tool to do it. Well, obviously, you know, no other animal can do that. They have to, you know, wait for these very slow processes of evolution, or perhaps, you know, some behavioral change over, you know, generations and generations before any sort of change takes place. So it's our cleverness, our ability to sort of escape, you know, the strictures of evolution, transcend them, to communicate, to form huge societies, to, you know, pass on knowledge from one generation to another. Language is probably key in all this. So all of the creativity, all of our best qualities in a lot of ways that we would say are our best qualities just turn out to be very dangerous for other species who have not transcended the bounds of evolution. It's just this sort of interesting mismatch. And so I don't make a moral judgment, to be honest. And I don't know that I don't know exactly what the role of morality is here. It's a very, very huge question, obviously. Now, one of the things you can say, I think, is that when our ancestors arrived in Australia, they were, you know, really unaware that they were, say, driving, you know, these enormous tortoises into oblivion. They didn't even have a concept of extinction. That's one of the points I make in the book. And, you know, we know what's going on, and we know that it is potentially quite dangerous for ourselves. We know all these things. We so far seem, you know, unable to do anything with that knowledge. Is that a moral failure? Is that a practical failure? You know, is that an evolutionary failure? I don't know. But I do think the point of the book, as you say, as I'm a journalist, I try to put that information out there for people. I hope that they will be thinking about it, because I really would argue that there's just nothing really more important for us to be thinking about right now. But what we do about that, as you say, I am not, you know, out there proposing a solution. I don't know what the solution is. If there is a solution, I certainly think there are ways that we could, you know, be minimizing our impact. We are now actually in the process of, you could argue, maximizing our impact. So we ought to be paying a lot more attention than we are.
Could you, for anyone that may not have thought about this before, which if they're listening to my show, it's probably not that many people, but could you just, you know, indicate a couple of ways that we could, you know, that are accessible right now to people through either their own personal actions or social activism or, you know, to minimize our impact?
Well, I think what's key when people ask, you know, what can I do? I certainly think everyone should be doing, you know, all the things that they know they should be doing to, for example, reduce their carbon footprint, as it's become known. But the key thing that people can do is, I think, make this a voting issue. You know, I would like a congressman, a senator who takes climate change seriously and who's willing to vote yes on legislation to, you know, try to reduce emissions. And that means, you know, an act as simple but as important as, you know, writing your congressperson and telling them you will be voting, you will be paying attention to what they do on this issue, and, you know, getting your neighbors to do the same thing and joining those groups that are lobbying for climate legislation, I think is a very important thing to do. People, you know, want, unfortunately, easy answers, and there are no easy answers on a societal level, but on a personal level, you know, just taking the time to do that, which unfortunately, you know, many of us just don't do, I think is the first step, and that's the threshold we've got to get over, that we are, as a society, committed to trying to do something. Then we can, you know, sort of argue over the details, but we've got to make that effort to have a politics that takes these issues seriously.
I hear, hear. I completely second that. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, Elizabeth Colbert. And thank you for your book, The Sixth Extinction in Unnatural History, published by Henry Holt. And I hope listeners will go out really avail themselves of the tremendous depth of insight and research that lays the threat to species and human survival before us. Good luck with the book. I'm so glad everyone's reading it. I hope everyone will continue to read it, more people will read it, and people will also follow your wise counsel about what we can do about it.
Well, thank you.
And thank you, listeners, too, for being with us this week on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. We're here every week on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well. Bye.